started looking last week at Revelation chapter 2 and 3, noticing that Christ examines his churches. We won't go over it again, but just to remind you that in chapter 1, John describes the vision that he had of Jesus standing in the midst of seven golden lampstands, and Jesus spoke to him in that vision and said that the lampstands represented the seven churches of Asia, indicating that he was there with those seven churches. He was present with those seven churches, and he knew what was going on in those seven churches, and he revealed to those seven churches in the first, in the early parts of the book of Revelation, the results of an examination that he had conducted. We noticed last week that the examination was personal. Jesus himself had examined those churches. He didn't send somebody else to examine them and report back to him. You know, he sent the apostles out on the Great Commission, and Jesus, even when he saw Paul, did not tell Paul what to do, because he had already commissioned the men to tell people what to do. They told Paul, if you will go into Damascus, somebody will come and tell you what to do. And Jesus sent a man named Ananias to tell Paul what he must do. But Jesus did not trust, apparently, this examination to some agent. He examined those churches himself. It was personal. The criticism was personal, and the promise of reward was personal. Secondly, the examination was spiritual. He was mainly interested in the spiritual reality of these congregations. He wasn't so much interested in the material realities, although he did mention those. In chapter 2 and verse 12, for example, unto the angel of the church in Pergamos write, these things says he who has the sharp two-edged sword. Now we realize that in that figure, that vision that John had, where he saw one like unto the Son of Man, there was a sharp two-edged sword proceeding out of his mouth, and we know and understand that that sharp two-edged sword was symbolic or symbolical of his word. And Hebrews 4 and verse 12 tells us, for the word of God is living and powerful and sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing even to the division of soul and spirit and of joints and marrow, and is a discerner of the thoughts and intents of the heart. We read and study the Bible long enough and seriously enough, we realize that God knows and understands the thoughts and intents of our hearts. He knows us intellectually. He knows us. Knows our intent. He knows our intellect and what we think and what we know and what we believe, and he knows what we intend to do, whether or not we intend to act on what we know and what we believe, as well as knowing, obviously, what we have done. He knows the thoughts and intents of the heart, and he has so revealed his word, convinced us that his word is a discerner, that is, it is something that makes a distinction between the thoughts and intents of the heart. It's a two-edged sword, and it cuts both ways, so to speak. Also in John 7, verse 24, Jesus himself said, do not judge according to appearance, but judge righteous judgment. Spiritual judgment leads to the righteous. And so Jesus, he conducted a personal examination of those seven churches. And so we know that his judgment was righteous, and therefore that it was dealing with spiritual reality. The examination was spiritual. Material wealth was not a consideration. Jesus knew, because he was with them. Remember, he promised, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them. I believe that's Matthew 18:20. He knew their circumstances, material and spiritual, but he is concerned primarily about their spiritual condition. Material wealth was not a consideration, but he could not help but notice the material reality of these congregations. In chapter 2 and verse 9, he says, I know your works, tribulation, poverty, but you are rich. And I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. He knew about their physical and material poverty, but he also knew about their spiritual richness, their spiritual wealth. They were materially poor, but they were spiritually rich. In chapter here, verse 17, referring to the church of Laodicea, because you say, I am rich, have become wealthy, and have need of nothing, and do not know that you are wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked.
There was the physical or material reality which the church in Laodicea was capitalizing on, which they were emphasizing, but Jesus did not emphasize those things. He knew about those things. But he knew what was most important, and that was the fact that, spiritually speaking, they were wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. All those things usually are modifiers of someone who is in poverty. Usually a person in poverty, he is wretched. He is in poor medical condition, physical condition. He's not well clothed. He's not generally well groomed. He's not, his teeth are bad. All kinds of things that we associate with poverty, and those things are collectively referred to here as wretched. He's a wretched thing. He's miserable. He is in misery because of his poverty, physically speaking. And they were miserable. They didn't even know it. Why did they not know that they were spiritually miserable? Because they were emphasizing their material well-being, their material wealth, and didn't realize that spiritually they were miserable. They were poor spiritually. They were blind spiritually. They were naked spiritually. They did not have on the clothing of righteousness that God alone can clothe us with. And so material wealth was not a consideration. He was there to examine them as to their spiritual reality, and thus he gives them no pat on the back for those material things, those material benefits, or material areas wherein they were prospering. No work on that. Because their spiritual condition far outweighed the material. Also, great reputation is immaterial when it comes to an examination by Jesus Christ. We need to keep these things in mind, by the way, because when Jesus made that promise to the apostles, where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in this promise, that promise is still extended to those who today are gathered together in his name. He's here. And he is, I believe, conducting an examination of the Forest Hills Church of Christ at maturity as he conducted an examination of the seven churches of Asia. He's conducting an examination of all of the churches of Christ in this county, all the churches of Christ in Georgia, all the churches of Christ in the United States, all the churches of Christ in the world. He is there. He is present. Is he? No, he's not physically present. As far as I know, he no longer has a physical body that disappears when he ascended back into heaven. But he is omnipresent because he can look down from heaven and see whatever is going on. He is fully aware, universally aware of what is going on in all of his churches. And not just that, he is aware of what is going on in all of the denominational churches. He knows how far they are from the truth. He knows how close some of them may very well be. He knows what's going on. He is fully aware. But as he conducts his examination of churches, as he did so in the first church, and as he does so in that of the 21st century, great reputation is the material. There are a lot of churches in the world today, churches of Christ, churches not of Christ, that have a great reputation. That doesn't matter. In Revelation chapter 3 and verse 1, the angel of the church in Sardis writes, these things, says he who has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. By the way, in each of those, he identifies himself as in some way with that vision of chapter 1. He is that person that John saw in that vision, as John described when he wrote down what that vision was all about. He who has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. Lord, he said, it's me, Jesus, the Son of God, the Son of Man. I'm the one conducting this examination. I know your work, that you have a name that you are alive. Now, name here means reputation. That was the reputation that they had. People generally, maybe just the people in this harvest, maybe the people in the surrounding communities and cities and counties, generally they thought the Sardis were that. They have got a reputation. That is a living church. I mentioned, I think, last week, or I know I mentioned before, the pejorative mossback. Some of our more liberal brethren consider us mossback because, as far as they're concerned, we're not on the loose. We're standing still. A rolling stone gathers no moss, but a stone that is still gathers moss. And they think, well, we are not rolling, and therefore we are, our backs are covered with moss. So some churches, because they're not standing still, they're on the loose, they have a name, they have a reputation that they are alive, but if what things they are doing are not authorized by God, it makes no difference what their reputation is. Great reputation is immaterial. Also, a little strength is needed. Where spirituality is concerned, or where spiritual strength is concerned, like real cream, a little bit of the heat. Spirituality, you need more, but you've got to have some. You've got to have some spiritual strength. It's needed. Oh, is it sufficient? No, it's not necessarily sufficient. You've got to have some spiritual strength. I don't even remember the name of it. When I was a kid, I read all manner of comic books, and there was one comic book I remember. I don't even remember the character's name. But in order to set up weight, because he was a skinny kid, he had skinny arms, and he was weak. He was going to build up his muscles, so he ordered a set of weights. And he couldn't even lift the bar before he put the weight on there. He was so, you've got to be at least spiritually strong enough to pick up that bar. You've got to be spiritually strong enough to pick up the weight and put them on the bar and begin to exercise so that you can build that strength. A little strength is needed, but it is not sufficient. And they did have a little strength. Here, I know your work. See, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it, for you have a little strength, have kept my word, and have not denied my name. Now, there are some other things we can say about that, and probably will later as we look at other aspects of this examination. But this open door, an open door is a figurative reference to an opportunity. As a matter of fact, when Paul writes his second letter to the Corinthians, he tells them that as he approached Troas from Ephesus on his way back to Corinth, he had hoped to see Titus in Troas, and Titus was going to let him know whether the Corinthians had received his letter well or not. Paul was anxious to hear from Titus the report of whether or not they had received 1 Corinthians well. Remember, 1 Corinthians, he dealt with a lot of problems. Those problems actually existed. They needed to repent. And while God certainly could have told him by inspiration, God apparently was allowing Paul to find out through natural means of communication. And so Titus was to take the letter to Corinth, stand there long enough to find out whether the letter was going to be well received or not. Then he was going to go back north through Macedonia and across the Aegean Sea to Troas and wait for Paul. So as Paul approached Troas from Ephesus on his way to Corinth, he had hoped to see Titus. Titus was there. In his letter to Corinth, Paul mentions this and says, there's a great deal of opportunities there.
But I could not study. I wanted to see Titus. I wanted to find out about whether or not you had received that letter. And so instead of staying in Troas and taking advantage of the open doors, the opportunity, he goes across the Aegean Sea and finally meets Titus in Macedonia. And Titus gave him the good news that they had well received this letter. Well, an open door is an opportunity. And when God opens the door for us, when he gives us an opportunity, no one can take that away. If he opens the door, no man can shut it. Remember when Noah and his family got on the ark? Noah didn't have to shut the door. The Lord shut the door. And I'm sure that when that rain started rising and getting up to being close to being over the people's heads, a lot of them probably came banging on that door. But it was the Lord that shut that door. Noah couldn't have opened it if he wanted to. I don't know that he did. I'm sure he probably wept for those people, but he had been preaching for 120 years while the ark was under construction. They hadn't responded to the preaching. I'm confident that those who had responded, if they had responded favorably to his preaching, they would have had a place on that ark. That was why I preached. But nobody did. It was only Noah and his wife and their three sons and the wife of each of those three sons. And when that door was shut, no man could open it. Well, here at the door, then the Lord opened, and he says, no man can shut it. But you know, when the Lord opens the door for us, it's up to us to walk through that door. We need to be on the lookout for those open doors, those opportunities to teach, those opportunities to help, whether spiritually or materially, some individual. I have set before you an open door. No one can shut it. So you have a little strength. But a little strength has to be exercised. We have to exercise that strength by doing what we have the strength to do. This old boy that got the weight equipment I tell you about, what he had to do, he had to work on this in that bar, you see. So every day he would go out and he would try to bust that bar, and it would be his exercise for the day. Finally, he was able to pick the bar. Then he started to do the rest with it. Eventually, he would put, you know, 2.5 pounds maybe on each end of the bar. Start doing reps with that. He had to start where he was and build up strength. And that's what congregation sometimes needs to do. You have a little strength. Have kept my word. They had kept it. They hadn't abandoned his word. But they weren't as strong as they needed to be, nor as strong as they could have been. And so he gave them this open door, presumably, as an opportunity to build themselves up spiritually. And you have not denied my name. Here, whereas name in the other passage refers to the reputation of the congregation, here name refers to everything that Christ stands for. It's his authority. You've not denied my authority. They had not begun a lot of programs for which they had no scriptural authority. Imagine they hadn't had many opportunities in the past, but he's given them one now. And they got a little strength, and they needed to exercise that little strength by taking advantage of that door of opportunity. Not only was it personal and spiritual, but the examination of the churches was also collective. He was examining them as collective bodies. The letter, for example, and we sometimes talk about the letters, but that was just one letter. That was the book of Revelation. It was written to 7 churches. Each of those 7 churches was referred to, but each of the 7 churches got the entire epistle that we refer to as the book of Revelation. It was just one letter. But that one letter had details dealing with each of these 7 congregations. The letter was sent to the churches. It wasn't sent to the individuals, but sent to the churches. And again, verses 10 and 11 of chapter 1, John says, I was in the Spirit of the Lord today, and I heard behind me a loud voice as of a trumpet saying, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last. And what you see, write in a book, and send it to the 7 churches which are in Asia, to Ephesus, to Smyrna, to Pergamos, to Thyatira, to Sardis, to Philadelphia, and to Laodicea.
And so this examination had to do with collective body. There's some who deny that the Lord's churches are collective bodies. Some say, well, they're just assembly. Well, then there would be no such thing as addressing a congregation. You have to address the people who made up the congregation. Now, there were local churches. These local churches weren't individual organizational collectivities with elders overseeing each church where there were men qualified to be elders, deacons serving each of those churches under the elders where there were men qualified to be deacons. They were organizational units. That's what he's examining. But these organizational units were made up of individual Christians. And so there are some things that are dealt with. We're talking about individual members. We'll get to that next week. But it's a collective examination. It wasn't only collective, but it was collective. The letter was sent to the seven churches. It examined collective work. This is something a lot of brethren miss. I'm not using the King James Version this morning, but I have preached this, a similar lesson to this particular part where I use the King James, because the King James makes a more obvious distinction between singular and plural second person pronouns. The King James has you and ye for the plural, and thou and thee for the singular. And that really helps sometimes. Because we don't really make that kind of a distinction the way we talk, and the New King James doesn't make that kind of distinction. But I'm asking you to take my word for it here as we go through these verses. Chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, to the angel of the church at Ephesus write, these things has he who holds the seven stars in his right hand, who walks in the midst of the seven golden lampstands. I know your works. Now, Paul, works is plural, your is singular. In the King James, it is I know thy works. What does that mean? He's talking about the congregation as a collective unit, as a singularity. It has its work in addition to the work of the individual members. And that's something some of our brethren can't understand or don't want to understand, that there is a difference between individual responsibility and congregational responsibility. There's a difference between the works of an individual or the works of the individuals that make up the local church and the works of the local church as a collectivity. He's doing it in this particular portion with their collective work. I know your work, your labor, your patience, and that you thou canst not. As a collectivity, you cannot bear those who are evil, and you, as a collectivity, have tested those who say they are apostles or not, have found them liars. And you, again, thou, singular, as a collectivity, have persevered and have patience and have labored for my name's sake and have not become weary. How about the things he said there about the church in Ephesus? He's dealing with them again with their collective work there. In that particular section of Scripture, also verses 8 and 9, and to the angel of the church in Smyrna, right? These things says the first and the last, who was dead and came to life. I know your works, tribulation and poverty, but you are rich. That's the collective you. As a congregation, it was rich. Why? Because their members were rich. And so it is true that in some areas, well, it's true of the congregation, it's true of the members. You can't have a faithful congregation, for example, without having faithful members. But you know, you can have a faithful congregation where some of the members are not faithful. It's the collectivity, the totality of it that's under consideration. The generality, in general, the members of the church at Smyrna weren't faithful, and so the congregation was. Well, he knew their work, he knew their tribulation, he knew their poverty, but they were really rich. And I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are of, are a synagogue of Satan. In chapter 2, verses 12 and 13, to the angel of the church in Pergamos write, these things says he who has the sharp two-edged sword. I know your work, again, that's singular, and where you dwell, singular, and where Satan's throne is, and you, singular, hold fast to my name, and did not deny my faith even in the days of in which Antipas, my faithful martyr who was killed among you, where Satan dwells.
Now this you is plural.
Because here he's talking about Antipas as one of many, you see. As one of many individuals, Antipas had distinguished himself.
And the word martyr, by the way, is a transliteration of the Greek word martyr.
When it translated witness. But in a situation where in a context where the witness was killed because of his testimony, they transliterated,
they spelled the Greek word with English letters because that has come into the English language
to mean a witness who was killed for his testimony.
Or a witness or one who was killed for a cause.
And so that's what Antipas, he was his faithful witness.
And he was killed among them there in Pergamos where Satan dwells. That's how evil that place was. He refers to it in that way.
In verse 18 and 19, to the angel of the church in Thyatira, write these things as the Son of God, who has eyes like a flame of fire and his feet like fine brass. I know your works, love, service, faith, and your patience. And after your works, the last are more than the first. And again, he's talking about their collective works here. Now, interestingly, he identifies himself as the Son of God, but in the vision, you might remember, and I'm going to remind you about him in case you don't, he was identified by John as one likened to the Son of Man. So what Jesus is doing, he is saying, one like the Son of Man, yes, I'm the Son of Man, but I'm also the Son of God. And Jesus was not the Son of a man, but he was the Son of Man. He was a human being. He was born into the human race by being born into the Jewish nation, by being born of a young Jewish woman. But then he says, eyes like a flame of fire, feet like fine grass, they were in the figure. So he still borrowed from that figure to identify himself as that one who was walking among the seven golden lampstands. He knew their collective works. And so that's what he had examined, and that's how he came to know about them. He had examined those works. He's not taking somebody's word for something. He knows what's going on because of his omnipresence and omnipotence and omniscience. The examination also was his collective standing. And there is a difference between the standing of a church collectively and the standing of one or more of its members individually. We'll talk about the other next week. But chapter 2, verses 1 and 12, says the angel of the church at Ephesus, right? These things says he who holds the seven stars in his right hand and walks in the midst of the seven golden lampstands. He's writing to the angel of the church, an angel, simply, I'm the Lord. That's another case where they just took the Greek word and they anglicized it or transliterated it by spelling it in the letters that might make it more familiar to us. But if they translate it, whenever they do translate that word, it's translated messenger. I believe that's the way it should be translated in these early chapters of Revelation. Later, he's talking about spiritual messengers, spiritual beings, and I think angel is appropriate there, and here it should be messenger, it seems to me. Because it's the angel of the church of Ephesus, the messenger, because he's dealing with their collective standing. And verse 12, the angel of the church in Pergamos writes, these things says he who has the sharp two-edged sword, and the church in Thyatira, and the church in Sardis, and the church in Philadelphia, and the church of the Laodiceans. And so he's dealing with their collective standing. He does deal, we'll talk about that next week, with other aspects of it. But for now, summing up, it was a personal examination, it was a spiritual examination, and it was a collective examination. And there are these two other aspects.